Earlier today, my co-host Kathleen Hayes sat down with Jim Bullard. He is the president of the and chief executive of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis. She spoke with him at the Jackson Hole Economic Symposium in Wyoming, and Mr. Bullard discussed the current economy, also a potential rethink in the way that the Federal Reserve is approaching monetary policy. Also, we talked about negative interest rates. We asked him about negative interest rates.
I'm not a fan of negative rates. I don't think they're likely in the U.S. because we have other things that we have other firepower that we can use if necessary. So I'm not thinking in terms of negative rates. I'm anxious to hear what this is an international conference here, so we're going to hear a lot about the experience overseas, and I'm anxious to hear what they have to say. You know what I've been thinking about negative rates? It's really a tax on the banking system. Because the rate of return that they get on their deposits at the Fed, if you push that into negative territory, then you're really taxing them. This was the whole idea of paying interest on reserves over the debate over the last 30 years. The banks always argued that they couldn't get interest on reserves and that this created a dead asset, and then this is costing them. And they said they should at least be able to get the market rate of return on that, on holding those reserves. And so finally they got interest on reserves in 2008 in the United States. In other countries they had it before, but in the United States we'd never had it till 2008. And now people start to say, well, instead of paying you the market rate, we're gonna put it down into negative territory. So that could be interpreted as a tax on the banking system, and then the banking system has to pass that on to somebody. Who are they gonna pass it on to? Either the shareholders in terms of profits, the borrowers in terms of rates that the borrowers from the bank can get, or to the depositors of the bank and start paying them negative rates. And so any way you look at it, if you think about negative rates as a tax on the banking system, that doesn't sound very stimulative when you describe it that way. And maybe that's why we've had very mixed results in Europe and Japan.
A lot of critics out there of the Fed, too many Fed speakers at once, what's being communicated, but I think really at the heart of it, one of the most fundamental criticisms is this. Look, you've tried all these, keeping rates low indefinitely, you've tried bond purchases, and the economy is still mired in slow growth, and businesses don't want to invest. Some people argue that, it's the Fed policy, it's uncertainty about it, it's the fact that rates are so low, they're going to have to move up more at some point. Why go into any long-term investment that it is one of the big factors holding back investment, which has been such a weak engine of growth right now? How do you answer those critics, and how do you analyze that?
Well, on the idea that there's too much talk about the Fed, I mean, one idea I've always had is that the private sector has probably 1,000 people that talk about the Fed all day, every day, around the world. It's a 24-hour-a-day talk about the Fed policy world, and the Fed only has a handful of people that that can respond. So I felt like it's important for the policymakers themselves to talk about all kinds of issues that come up about Fed policy, all legitimate issues, and we're talking about a macro economy, which is a big, complicated object. So there are going to be all kinds of issues all the time, and that's the way it's going to be. So I felt it was very important for the Fed to be involved in this debate. Otherwise, you're letting the private sector entities drive the debate, and they're taking positions. They have positions in the markets, and they're making bets and stuff like that. I don't mind them commenting, but I don't think you want them driving policy. So anyway, so that's one thought on it.
That's one of the best defenses I've heard of that, right? The voice of the thousands versus the voice of the few. But again, on this question then of uncertainty, weak spending, businesses that don't want to step up, and the Fed, some saying, being at the heart of the matter. They have distorted and disrupted sort of the natural workings of the financial system and what drives investments, and that is one of the problems right now.
I think the threat to increase the policy rate, say 200 basis points over the next 2 years or a little bit longer, that has been looming out there as a threat, has not been a good description of what we're actually doing. And so I have felt like that's distorting investment decisions and distorting market pricing in various ways. We're in the middle of the second year after QE ended. So we had all of 2015. We moved once at the very end of the year. We've had all of 2016, and we haven't moved so far this year. And markets have us only moving once probably by the end of the year. So we're just not moving at a pace. You know, moving once a year is not really normalization. That's really not a normalization program. That's kind of nothing. So I think you should have a better description of what's actually going on than what we've got. And that's why I came with this other conception of what's going on. But I do think you can make a case that it's distorting investment decisions.
Earlier today, Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen, in her remarks, she left open the door for a Federal Reserve rate increase at its September 20 to 21st policy meeting. But she also hedged her comments in ways that give the bank, well, an economic data dependent out, if indeed the economic data is less than sanguine. Earlier today, also, my co-host Kathleen Hayes spoke with Jim Bullard, president and chief executive of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, and she asked whether there was a need for a Federal Reserve rethink on monetary policy and wondered if that is what is actually happening.
I think there is something of a rethink going on, and I think it is because inflation has surprised to the low side. I would have thought 5 years ago, if you told me where we are today, with a balance sheet over $4 trillion and a policy rate still, under 50 basis points, I would have said, oh, you must have 5% inflation or something like that. And that hasn't turned out to be the case. So I think there is a rethink about models, Phillips curve in particular, which has long been at the heart of a lot of thinking about the economy. Those relationships don't seem to be very good over the last several years. The economy seems to behave differently at extremely low interest rates. You've got the Japanese example sitting out there. You've got the double dip recession in Europe. So there's over the last 5 years. So you've got a lot going on to think about and to adjust to in the world of monetary policy, which I find it fascinating because it's an endlessly fascinating subject. But it's not easy.
Jim, what do you think about inflation? This persistently low inflation, even though central banks around the world have thrown so much at it, low to negative rates, endless bond purchases, buying corporate bonds, buying ETFs, is, do you get the feeling that low inflation is somewhat incurable?
Well, I doubt that. I've thought about giving a speech about inflation around the world. Let's check out Venezuela. Let's check out Argentina. Let's check out other countries that have had very high inflation rates. So they seem to have been able to break out of the mold of the low inflation environment globally. Now, usually when that happens, there are other problems in the country, and both of those countries have a political upheaval of various kinds, and usually governments that want or need revenue from other sources other than their tax base. It's definite. They're showing the way, though. It's definitely still possible to have inflation. I'm not sure we really want to go down that kind of a route. So the inflation, when we say we want to hit 2% inflation, we want to hit it through, very conventional methods. And that seems to not be working quite as well as it did in the past.
Globally, in the last FOMC minutes, the Fed was concerned about a number of different areas. Remember from China? Debt to GDP, exchange rate instability, European banks. Let's start with China then. In a nutshell, are you worried? What are you and your team seeing, and how much does that influence the Fed's next decision on an interest rate increase?
I don't put as much weight on these global factors as other people. So let me give you my argument. People say that because the world is more globalized, now we're going to start paying attention to the shock in a remote province of China or something happens in Latin America or something like that. That is not what economic theory says. Economic theory says if you've got the flexible exchange rates between countries, as we do between Japan, Europe, and the U.S., which are the main blocks, and and most of the other main blocks. Then when there's a shock in one part of the world, the exchange rate is supposed to move, and that's supposed to adjust offset most of the shock. And that then you can conduct independent monetary policies in the various countries, and this is a way that you stabilize all the economies of the various countries. And I think on the whole, that's still the right model to have in mind. If you look at some of the things that have been talked about over the last year, let's say we were at Jackson Hole last year, you had the Chinese devaluation and a big, scare about that. I said that I did not think it was that big of a deal. I turned out to be right about that. Then we came into January, and again, people brought up China, something's going on in China. I said it wasn't that big of a deal. I was right about that again. We got Brexit. People say, oh my God, if they vote no on Brexit, that's going to be a huge deal. They did vote no. I don't see it. So people are overemphasizing how much this can really come back to a big economy like the U.S. It certainly causes, these things have caused global financial market volatility, but that volatility tends to settle down after a while because the fundamentals don't really change. And, something like Brexit, how is a trade agreement between the U.K. and the continent going to come back to affect actual real things in the U.S. through trade relationships or something like that? All the estimates are that those effects are extremely small. So it's very important for the U.K., and it's kind of important for the continent. It's important for the European project, but it's not important for the U.S.
In terms of risks of keeping rates too low for too long, people who are concerned say, look, by the time you can see the excesses or some sort of bubble where people have gone, and we know there's been a lot of reaching for yield, right? It's too late. How do you approach that aspect? Because you've got your regime, you said, oh, probably not going to have to raise rates much at all. Meantime, the skeptics would say, yeah, Jim, you and your team with your view are going to let some problems fester, and we're going to have to deal with them later. And it's not going to be fun.
Yeah. So I'll be right up front about this. Our framework does not address the issue of asset price bubbles. So that's just something that is not included. However, if you look at most forecasting, typical forecasting models, FRB US or Meyer and Associates or Macroeconomic Advisors or GDP Now or whatever you want to look at, those kinds of things, they're not talking about asset price bubbles. They just have sort of mechanical relationships in the economy. They try to track the business cycle, and on they go. So I think you want to think about these things in judgmental terms, where you're making a judgment separate from the model about how big a problem is asset valuation, and would we or would we not want to use monetary policy to try to control that. This is a very important issue for monetary policy. It has been the most important issue over the last 20 years. We had the tech bubble, and we had the housing bubble, and there was, and if we have another bubble, there will again be a debate about what to do about it. So none of this is in my framework. So that just has to be handled separately. But right now, I think you can make a case that we're certainly not in any kind of bubble territory the way we were with the housing bubble or the way we were with the tech bubble. Maybe somebody can make a case. But also, I think the Fed has beefed up its tracking of this kind of stuff a lot. We do get a financial stability report quarterly. We look at all kinds of nooks and crannies in financial markets and try to see if there's anything that's catching that looks troublesome. So I think our radar is much better than it used to be. But if we do get into a bubble situation, the committee's going to have to make a judgment about what to do about it, and we'll have to face that.
That was Jim Bullard. He is the president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, speaking with, of course, my co-host, Kathleen Hayes, at the Jackson Hole Economic Symposium in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. And he was speaking in the context of remarks from Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen, signaling growing conviction that the central bank will raise short-term interest rates in the weeks or the months ahead. Of course, their policy meeting is set for September the 20th and the 21st, but perhaps even as important is the Federal Reserve's decision hinging on whether the labor market is showing steady gains. The Labor Department will report on September the 2nd about the labor conditions in the United States in August. Job gains have been averaging about 190,000 a month over the past 3 months. The bond market, a little bit of a sell-off today. The 10-year down 16/32nds with a yield of 1.62%, and the 30-year bond down 19/32nds with a yield of 2.29%. This is Taking Stock. I'm Pim Fox. My co-host Kathleen Hayes. This is Bloomberg.